how many alcoholics does it take to schedule a time to record a podcast and set up their own tech gear? Me and you, we've worked it out. This is very...
I know, it's really, it is impressive.
Thank you for taking the time, Holly, to come on The Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. I wanted to talk to you now because always in January, there's a huge influx of people getting sober. It's been that way for as long as I've been sober, which is most of my adult life at this point.
How many years?
How long are you sober?
It'll be 9 years this April. Yeah. And I count the time, I think this is important. I count the time that it took between trying to not drink and not drinking. And I think that's really important time.
Wait, so you count the time while you were still drinking, but trying not to drink?
Not in that 9 years, but I mean in internally inside. The April 14th, 2013 was the last time I had a drink. But I started to stop in October of 2012. And that...
Right.
I think that time counts. It's so important, that time. I think it's really important to count time. But then at the same time, I think so defeating.
Why? Why is it so defeating?
We measure things in success, in results. We still do, to our detriment. And we discount anything that doesn't necessarily look the way that we as a society think it should look. And so I think that what matters the most is that first morning that you wake up.
I look at it. I do look at it as like today, even though I have spent most of my adult life sober.
Yeah.
I am under no delusion that I could drink again.
Yeah.
I hope I don't, because I just can't do my life unless I'm clear-minded at all. Like I really do know that to my core.
Yeah.
Otherwise I would not have stayed sober this long, but I feel like every day is a new day.
Yeah.
And there is something about consecutive time, for me at least, that at about 5 years, I thawed out. It took me that long to come back to life.
Well, what did you do in those first 5 years?
I was abstinent in those 5 years.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of self-reflection that included multiple modalities to really understand, you know, why I was so uncomfortable in my skin, just being. And ultimately, I think a lot of people who self-medicate, we all tend to have similar traits with big feelings and big reactions and feeling things very intensely and immense self-loathing.
Yeah.
Immense self-loathing. Yeah. Terrible self-esteem.
It's so funny. This summer, I was in Italy for a bit of the summer, and I was with one of my friends, and she's a yoga instructor and has a yoga studio there. And she's not in recovery. And we were talking, and I just assumed that we both found it to be terribly uncomfortable in our bodies. And I said something like, it's so hard to remain in here. Like, I went out all the time. And she goes, I love it in here. It was so crazy because I just assumed all of us have a really hard time living in our bodies.
I think people who don't self-medicate in some capacity, they're comfortable in their bodies most of the time, not unusually uncomfortable, where, to the point where they want to use something to get out of light.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Let me just soften the edges on this a lot because it feels really brutal being here.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling like that for as long as I remember having memories. I think for me, and I don't know whether you feel like this, but finding drugs and alcohol for me definitely saved my life because I was not young enough to learn tools how to live in the world without self-medicating. And I'm pretty sure I would have killed myself had I not have found drugs and alcohol. I think they kept me alive and allowed me to be in the world as long as I...
It made it manageable, right? Like it gave you a place to go.
Yeah.
And I feel the same. I feel totally the same.
An out button when I needed it.
Yeah.
I have a lot of compassion for people who struggle with alcoholism and addiction. And it is a really brutal mindset to have at times. But I wanted to talk to you because, as well, like I said, a lot of people are considering getting sober at this time. And you wrote a book called Quit Like a Woman. And I wanted to talk to you because there's not just one way to get sober. Yeah. There's multiple different ways. For my listeners who have not read your book, would you give us a top line of the kind of key factors and the key issues that you talk about in Quit Like a Woman?
Well, it's obviously focused on the female gender, right? And so it's speaking to an audience that historically is not necessarily considered in the construction of recovery. And it is a book that is meant to anthropologically dive into why we ended up where we are, drinking before COVID even, skyrocketing, women's drinking, women's addiction, women's liver failure, skyrocketing. And it's a different trend among men, but non-binary, queer women, people of color, all of those intersections, addiction is skyrocketing.
Do you think that alcoholism is gendered? Because if you've written this from a female perspective and it's addressing the female drinker, how do you think addiction affects women differently to men?
I think when it comes to alcohol, one of the most obvious points is that women historically and currently keep picking up things they're supposed to be and things they're supposed to do. It's not gotten better. It's gotten worse just from appearance to even it's even a conflict whether or not to age with grace or to age with Botox, right? Nothing is easy and we're supposed to essentially still provide emotional unpaid labor at home. There's just like a list of things that we're supposed to, a list of boxes we're supposed to check. And I think it's impossible. I don't have a better word than impossible. And so I think that there's just like the just being a woman. And then also historically, we have been sold drugs to cope with meeting the standards that we're supposed to keep. And so Milltown or Mommy's Little Helper volume, like anti-anxiety pills were first marketed to women who couldn't get a date. And so I think like when you look at like the history of what's been thrown onto women and then also the history of the coping mechanisms we've been given, we've been taught basically to drink and drug it away. So I think there's just bad luck.
I think that women have more predisposition because of their stresses and the unrealistic expectations of them to be prone to alcoholism more than men.
If you like clinically, sure. Like we experience anxiety and depression at rates that are greater than men. I think that a lot of times we want to say, what does the DSM say? Are we predisposed genetically? I think more than anything, culturally predisposed.
I think it depends how you define addiction or alcoholism. Like, how do you define alcoholism? How do you define that for yourself?
Yeah, I do. And also, I think it's interesting to talk about alcoholism.
Or addiction.
But like, the way that I define addiction, I use a basic definition of it. Anything that we do continuously that we can't stop doing that harms us.
See, I have a different definition.
Okay, what is it?
So my definition of addiction, alcoholism, whatever you want to call it, is when something is causing a substantial problem in one or more areas of your life, right? Because you may be able to have 5 glasses of wine a night. It doesn't cause a problem for you. Things affect people differently. So for me, it's like when something causes a problem, it causes a problem. Sexually acting out.
Sure.
You're in a partnership. Might not cause a problem for your work, but might cause a problem for your partner or for you if you keep getting yourself in bad situations. So I look at it as something that's causing a problem.
Yeah, that's what I said. That is, it's something that you continue to do despite negative consequences is another way of saying it's fucking you up a bit. And one of the ways that in my book, I break it down is just know what you can and can't fuck with. One of the ways you can look at how people come to treating addiction, right, is that there is a period of time where they're in the ether and they have no idea what the hell's going on with themselves. Like they just don't know
denial.
What's that? Right. Denial. But also it just doesn't even touch in. It doesn't even actually like
pass
the surface.
It's not even a frame of reference.
And then
hasn't got
and then there is an inkling like, oh, maybe this behavior is maladaptive or maybe this is ruining my life. And then there's aware and then there's total awareness. Right. And I think it's a really there's a long tail to get from ether to actually doing something about it. And so I do think that a lot of people are still
the awareness piece.
What's that?
The awareness piece, people can stay in for a long time, that kind of awareness hell.
And then not doing anything
about it. Something is fucking you up. and not being able to, being like, I can't, I keep doing this thing and I know that I must stop and I cannot.
Yeah. It's a whole long process. Yeah,
that is, oh man, that is the, that,
that's
that,
the worst.
That's
the, yes.
That is the worst.
It is.
That is the worst. So do you think that, is there another component that makes addiction for you? Is there a spiritual component? Or is it just a physical?
But it's all of that. It's not just a physical thing, right?
Not for me. I'm just curious.
Yeah. In my book, I break down five different, there's a lot of different theories of what causes addiction. Like Gabor Mate believes in really like a trauma-focused theory, right? That we're hurt, we're trying, we're basically using a coping mechanism to soothe our trauma, to soothe our hurt. There's choice. People still believe it's just a choice. And that at any time you can stop and you choose to become addicted. And there's the disease model, which believes
that's my least favorite.
You're a chronic relapsing condition that you'll never break out of. There is the globalization of addiction. Bruce Alexander says it's capitalism. It's just like living in a free market society where you're, you know, turned into a means to an end. And then there's Maya Shvalovitz and Mark Lewis who believe that it's learning, that it's just, it's adaptive. And I think that for me, the truth lies
of all of them.
In between all of that, but I probably align the most with is Maya Shvalovitz and also Mark Lewis, which is that it's adaptive, it's learned, and it can be unlearned.
Which is also tied to, I do love Gabor Mate's work, and I really do believe that trauma, and you dig down deep enough, at least in my experience of having spent thousands of hours with people who are addicted in various capacities, I've yet to meet someone who hasn't got some trauma. Okay. So I think that adaptive piece is really connected to that trauma piece as well.
It's all, it is, I think it's all connect, like all of it. Like I think that in this space that there is a lot of, it's an interesting space, like recovery space is an interesting space because you can have coexisting opinions that either are complimentary or even, you know, competitive, but we tend to have a really, no, that's wrong. And I think all this stuff can live together. All this stuff can somehow find a way.
And having been in recovery as long as I have, I don't talk about my recovery a lot, but it is the cornerstone for everything that I am. It has come from the bedrock of my recovery. Yeah. And it is actually the most important thing in my life. And if I don't have my recovery, I know that I will not be able to have the life that I want. So I do feel very passionately about recovery. And for me, at least, even though I have been sober and in active recovery for so many years, I don't know what it's like to not be in active recovery. Yeah. I still don't feel I'm a healed person.
No.
It's ongoing. And
forever.
And the reason, again, why I wanted to talk to you is that I do think it is really important that we stop having competing modalities because ultimately, I am a huge advocate for 12-step recovery. It's free.
Yeah.
You can take what you want and leave the rest. If the patriarchy languaging is problematic, which it is for many, get rid of it. Make your higher power your sponsor or the wind or Jesus, whatever the hell you want. Do whatever works for you. Take what you want that feels like it can help you. And leave the rest. We don't have to follow a dogma of one or the other, or you could take bits of all of what you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want my listeners to know that there are multiple choices and investigate and get your book. Look at the different modalities that you're talking about and check them out. Mm-hmm. See what you connect with. Because there isn't a one size fits.
And people don't typically just use one thing, right? You have used 12 steps. You've also done therapy, I'm assuming. And there is a whole bunch of stuff that individuals have to do to be in active recovery. And it is. It's a lifetime worth of work. And I don't know anybody that just did this one thing and stuck with it and never tried anything else. And if they did, it was a pretty limited experience because we continuously evolve and we have to meet the next phase of ourselves with different tools a lot of the times. So,
oh man, it is exhausting sometimes. I don't know about you, but I have had a beast of a year.
The worst year I've ever had.
Right?
Like, and I mean, I'm not being exaggerated.
Same.
And I almost died years ago. Like, this is worse. Why is it bad for you? Why is it so bad for you? Tell me.
Honestly, the emotional pain that I have been in this year was comparable to the last year when I was using, where I was just like, Really?
Do you think that's like, okay, do you think that's like feeling again, like we feel, right? Like we feel. I was talking to one of my friends last night who's in recovery, and she's the sweetest thing. And she was saying something like about how hard it is to be in her body and how much she feels other people's pain and the pain of the world. And do you think it's like a feeling of a collect? Do you think that's a collective thing? Like that you're feeling the collective because you're more porous?
I think it's a bit of both. I am always the person who really has a hard time watching the news because I end up in tears, or I feel like I'm not doing enough, or I feel the pain of all the dogs and cats that are in the shelters and I want to do something.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful quality to have. That's what motivated me to make the conversation, because I wanted to share tools and stories and connect women through their pain and help people recover and feel unified. That came from my feeling deep empathy. So it's beautiful to have that. But I think also for me, being in lockdown, I have not been able to use my usual escape methods to distract myself or get validation from the outside world or all of my little loopholes that I've used to plug the holes.
Yeah.
Even though I'm active in my recovery, of course, I've got those places. I think all of those stopped working or were removed.
Yeah.
And therefore, the wounds were left open. And then, of course, there's what do you do? You have to face them.
Yeah.
And I also think that cyclically, every 7 years, all of ourselves regenerate, right?
Well, and all that you just said, and I keep on thinking this is a 7-year cycle.
So I think it's timing as well. It's, could some of this stuff have happened if we weren't in a lockdown and pandemic and everything we've all been through? Possibly, but it was a catalyst for everything. And then just not being able to escape at all, being really stuck with the feelings that have been really overwhelming and scary to you.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Some days I'm, you know, better than others. And other days I'm like, no, I'm still in it.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Same.
Every day is a new day. And that's what I hold on to.
Yeah.
Actually, when I reached out to you, you were like, yeah, I'm not talking about anything at the moment, but okay, I'll do this with you. And I thought, oh yeah, that's how I feel. Like, I don't really
want to talk to anybody. No, I absolutely don't.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
We don't have to. I don't have to. My editor definitely wants me to. There's people that are vested in me talking still, but at the same time, I'll be okay if I don't talk for a minute. And I think—
Guess what? They will be okay.
They will be okay. Everyone will be okay. But it is, I do want to do this just because I know you're putting this out around the new year. And I do think it's such an extraordinarily like opportunistic time and also really hard time. It's just hard. It's hard to live right now. It's hard to be alive right now. And I think are we allowed to cuss here?
I can cuss.
What's so fucked up about it is that I feel like, and I wonder if you feel any of this, but I've been through it. I have seen the bottom of it. And it's really ugly. And I never thought emotionally I would ever feel that again. You know what I mean? Like just like hope, a little hopeless, a lot hopeless, exhausted, like just exhausted by everything. And just everything feels like walking through mud. And I'm just like, I already did all of this work. I did it. And this is supposed to support me right now. And I in my mind that I would never have to go through that again.
You're just describing exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
You are describing exactly how I feel. And I feel a sense of fury that I am having to go to that place again. I'm in that place again. And I feel like, motherfucker, how many years of work do I have to do to not be back here?
That's right.
Would that not, has it, why does this not sustain me? And it feels like there's no floor.
You know what I mean?
Like for many years, I felt like I had a floor.
It's
like, where the fuck did the floor go?
I'm through it. I think, and the only thing I can make sense of is that, okay, this was always there. This layer was always there. And we were strong enough to go, whatever, DEFCON 4 or whatever that is. We were strong enough to go gently through it. But we're now down to... And I don't know if I have that. DEFCON 1, DEFCON 4.
Cool.
But we're now down to, we're strong enough. And I'm saying this kind of like tongue in cheek, because this is a lot of, this could be total bullshit. But I do believe somewhere in me that this is just getting down to stuff that I was probably not strong enough to wrestle with before. And that at this point, oh, it sucks really bad. And it feels like regression. It feels like I thought I would never have to do this again, but here I am. But then at the same time, I am wondering, maybe this, all this pain, because it's pain. It's like, it's a very,
I know,
it's just pain.
Visceral.
Yeah. And I wonder if it just didn't have a safe place to come up before, because it would have annihilated me. So I don't know.
Yeah. Weirdly, what you're saying is literally what I said to my women's group on Wednesday, where I said, I have to believe that the universe is not giving me more than I can handle, but it sure as fuck feels like I can't really handle it.
Yeah.
And all I know is that women that have gone before me, and weirdly, I spoke to a woman the other day who's 84 years old, who's in recovery. And she said, oh, you didn't think that that was it. Did you? Like, you had felt the depths of pain like you had never felt before, and that was like the only time you were going to feel it. He's like, no, I'm 84 and I just went through another one at 82. And I'm like, oh my God. And what I know to be true is that there is freedom on the other side.
Of course
there is.
There
was last time, but when you're in it, it's like, how long is this going to last? What is the way forward? What is the purpose of this? And we can't know because we're in it. And by the way, it's the same for people who just stop using, right? It's, they're in this pain. It's a similar pain. And there is freedom on the other side.
That's right.
There is,
but it also feels like it's just your mind plays tricks on you, and it's, you're going to be like this forever. You just like
go
into this space and this is it for the long haul. And I think it's so refreshing. Today, I went out on my back porch and I sat in my rocking chair and I looked at the sun. I was about to get in a bath and I was just like, God, take this away. Literally said it out loud. God, whatever this is, just take it away. I'm done. And this, God takes it away, I think. And I say God in whatever sense. I don't really care.
Sure.
I'm not religious, but God makes sense to me. But to me, this feels like God taking it away, because I think that you're 28 years and you still have to deal with this bullshit. And there's something that is sweet about that. And we both do know that what you don't want always yields what you do want. Like the mm-hmm. worst pain always somehow yields like the biggest blessing. I don't know why that's true, but I find that to be true. So
pain is the cornerstone of
growth. It is.
Look, your book came from your pain.
Yes.
My book, my series, all of the stuff I did came from my pain. So it's, I know that there is purpose to it. It's just being in it and not expecting it and being confused by, wait, why am I here? And just trying. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago and I just couldn't stop crying in the interview. And I was like, this is terrible. This is really unprofessional. What's going on? Luckily, I was talking to a woman who really had immense empathy for me. And she was like, it's okay. But I was like, there's a phenomenal generosity in people sharing their journey.
Yeah, there is.
And for me, I've been able to turn my pain into purpose by sharing my journey. And that's why I do welcome, even though it is uncomfortable at times, I do welcome the opportunity to share this part of the journey, because no one bypasses this. Nobody.
No.
Bypasses this.
No, not if there's theories about growth. I think that there are I think drugs and alcohol are the bypass, or anything can be the bypass. I don't know about you, but I'm imagining this is true. Like, I signed on for this. I signed on for all of it, and like running straight into the sword. And I think that I have to remember that in times like this, that like you signed up for the real thing, to look at it and to examine it and be with it. And
you signed up for the truth, and you signed up for a life that was authentically yours, whatever that is, but it wasn't drinking and using. Yeah. That was not the path.
Well, it was at one point.
Right. Right.
Okay.
It stopped.
That's working. Right. It wasn't the right. It was the path away from that. I don't know. Anyway, it feels really nice. I just want to say, to hear somebody else, because it feels, I think when you are in extreme amount of like pain and confusion, it feels, especially if you've done your work or whatever it is, it feels, it's a lonely place.
It does. And you also feel like you should be somewhere different. And there's a lot of shame attached to being in a painful place and then letting people know that you're in a painful place. because I don't know about you, but I'm always the person who has it together and has like baller recovery. And this is part of having baller recovery is that I'm honest when I'm suffering.
I know.
And I think
that's part of it.
For anyone listening who is suffering to any degree and is wondering, number one, if their pain will ever end, and number two, if there's anything that they can do about it, there is a lot of things you can do. And one of the first things that I would recommend anyone to do is to find a trusted friend or someone that you trust and share what's going on with you. Let people know how you're feeling inside to the best of your ability, because that immediately lightens the load a little bit. It's a weird anomaly.
That's right.
What would you say were some of the biggest gifts from a sober life for you?
I think from early on, what stage?
Because there are different things. Let's just stay now. At this, let's do some glass half full stuff.
Yeah. What are the gifts right now in this terrible fucking year of sobriety? Okay. I think it's one that I know I like sobriety. I think that's a gift, right? It's really hard to be here, but it's even harder to artificially not be here. And that having that film around me and between this experience, I don't think I could survive it. And I think that, like you were saying, you don't think you could have survived earlier on without, and I feel the same. I think drugs and alcohol saved my life. And then also at this point, I think it would just be the end for me. So that's a gift. I think another gift right now is, like, I was in that same rocking chair talk with God and the sun. I just was like, I know one thing about myself, and I know that I keep going. I know that I can get up. And there's that Pema Chodron speech, fail again, fail better. And I fail and I fail again and I fail better and better. And so I think there's that. And then there's just what I'm working on right now that I wouldn't be otherwise. I'm just like, I'm actually working on this idea of, imagine that you're just dropped into this body right now. No backstory, just a soul dropped into this weirdo Holly. And go look at the world, be amazed. And I think that I wouldn't even entertain a thought like that if I didn't allow myself to be in this like unadorned raw pain. But I'm in this this unadorned raw pain, and I'm able to just be like, where do I go next with this? Do you know what I mean? Because you've done all the things, and it's like, I've done the trauma work, I've done the EMDR, I've done the EFT, oh my God, I've had all the massages and the acupuncture.
Yeah.
I meditate, I run, I read, I journal, yeah. I call friends,
yeah.
I drink, you know, so much water, whatever it is. I do all the things, but it's just like, you're on a cliff. There's no more things. What do you do when you're on the cliff and you've run out of things to do? And it's just, okay, then you just start working. You've run out of all the places. You're just at the end. So you just start working with this. And so that's what it feels. And that feels like a gift. There's that saying by Deepak Chopra, if you're happy for a reason, then you're not happy. And so I'm sitting in this and I'm like, this is the worst year. There's nothing that's making me like happy. So guess what? This is a rich and fertile training ground to learn how to be okay without relying on some external circumstance to change that for me. And that's a really interesting place to be. So that feels like a gift of sobriety.
That is so eloquently put. I tend to agree with you. I do think that it is really fertile ground for just being okay without anything. Who are we without all of the things that give us our identity and process us and all of our tools? And I'm in a very similar place. Like, weirdly, I'm in a very similar place. And I think that's why it's so uncomfortable, because let me ask you a question. In that big list of things that you said you did, there was one thing I did not hear, which is, have you done parts work? Have you done IFS, internal family system?
Oh, yeah, I did that with a therapist. I'm the black sheep. I'm the bad one.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm like the one that always fucks everything up. And my sister is like the one that fixes everything. And that rocked my world. Because I was like, oh my God, of course I feel like a child. I'm 42 years old and I'm still the one that fucks up everything.
Yeah, that work is really powerful.
Yeah, it is. When you say, I've read a book on it and I've worked a little bit with it in therapy, but have you done some deep work on that? Like,
I've just started doing that work, and because I too have done trauma work and EMDR and cognitive behavioral therapy. And have you done DBT?
Yes.
So dialectical behavioral therapy. There are so many different modalities. I don't know if you watched that Gabor Mate doc, The Wisdom of Trauma, but he does some pretty incredible work with psilocybin. And there are people who are sober who do this work. It is very effective for trauma. I'm so curious about it. I'm afraid to do it. As a sober woman, I think it's a tricky one, although there are people who are sober who do it.
Yeah.
But I'm still curious to see what the long-term outcome is of psilocybin treatment.
Well, it's really interesting because years ago, I was entertaining doing ayahuasca. And we talked about it on a podcast, and all the women in this private group that we had were like, I've been saving this Molly, and like all this stuff. And it just felt like I was too young and naive to understand, like, I'm not responsible for other people's decision making. So I don't have to be sober for everyone. I wrote this really long post and I was like, I'm never going to do it. And then I did it last year. I did psilocybin, the guide, last year. And like, I can talk about why I did it, but like the very short story of it is that I used to use SSRIs and I can't do it anymore. It didn't work for me. And it actually made me not okay. So I did this. I got a referral from a psychiatrist and I worked with this guy and it was the worst thing that I've ever been through. And so I don't
really
mean to scare anyone off of it, but.
Wait, was it ayahuasca and?
It was just mushrooms. It was just psilocybin.
Really? It was the worst experience.
Yeah, I threw up and I had to take 3 days off of work. I was sick the whole entire time and it was just terrible. I'm not closing the door on using plant medicine. I follow on Google like psilocybin treatment and ayahuasca and whatever for addiction. And there are a lot of promising studies.
What was your actual experience with the
drug?
What happened in your mind?
Oh, okay.
Was it dark?
So this is what's interesting. So years ago when I wanted to do it, it was because I'd never felt more solid in my entire life. Like then around year 4 or 5 sobriety, I just was like unflappable in some way. And so what happened in my mind was it like melting candle wax and no God anywhere. And a fear that I was going to be stuck forever that way. And also just this, oh my God, I don't alter my consciousness. I don't alter myself like that.
Oh, right. And like, like, oh my gosh. So your conscious mind was not okay with that much of a dramatic shift.
I was not okay with it. And I think what's so interesting, I came back and I was like, you know, I like my reality. I like my very clear, I like everything in its place. I'm going to cling to the like reality that we're in. But I don't know if that's the end of it. It was just, there was a lot going on, whatever. I do think like at the end of the day, it wasn't a bad experience. And I feel like I left about 20 pounds of pain in a toilet bowl or whatever I threw up in. It did feel like it moved something. It did. It felt like it kind of moved a darkness I could not move within myself, that I couldn't reach through all the other things that I tried. But it wasn't.
You mean depression?
No, not depression, like pain, like heavy body pain. It's interesting. My friend wrote about it this morning. And so he writes about ayahuasca and addiction recovery. It was interesting because he said, I think he's in 12 steps. And he was just saying, there's actually like 12-step guides for using plant medicine, which I thought was wild. But I think what Alex was saying was that saying that it's like a shortcut or a bypass or cheating, it's not easy. It's painful. And it's one of the hardest things. Like doing that kind of work is hard. And he's very right about that. It's not like it wasn't fun. I did not enjoy it. But I did it when I felt like I had a very different reason for doing it. There was a period of time where it was like, yeah, I want to do ayahuasca. Bring it on. And it came from that same source of, yeah, I want to get the fuck out of here. And this was more like, all right, I'm willing to try this and I want to do this and I'm ready to do the work. Like I'm purely ready to go in and do this work to like actually work with this thing I can't overcome otherwise.
Thank you for sharing that experience. I'm just super curious about how people are long term.
Yeah.
I have another question for you, which is, what do you think about the kind of Instagram psychologists? Because there's also in COVID, a lot of these people have popped up and have giant followings. Because whether they're talking about boundaries or trauma, or it's like pop culture recovery language. And sometimes I think, well, that's great. It's making recovery accessible for everybody. And then I also think there's also a massive responsibility. And who are these people? And what is their background? And why are they qualified to speak on this stuff? Because a lot of people are listening to them. So I wanted to know what your thoughts were.
I think my thoughts are always rooted in the same thing that, like, the book is rooted in, or all my work is rooted in, which is, I think that we live in a society that is, Thomas Szasz is this, he's one of the first psychiatrists that was like an anti-psychiatrist, and he's very controversial. So I don't agree with all his stuff, but I think it's really interesting that he talks about how we moved from a society governed by church to a society governed by medicine, as in, be this way, take these drugs. These drugs are illegal. You get arrested if you do them. You can't kill yourself. And he talks a lot about something called like a fiat currency system, means that like currency isn't tied to the gold.
Fiat standard. Like the car?
Fiat, like a fiat currency system, is nothing's tied to a gold standard. There's no gold in the bank. You can just make up currency out of thin air, like crypto. And
like crypto.
Thomas talks about fiat diagnosis. Like, there's no gold standard of diagnosis anymore. Disease used to mean like one thing, and now there are things that are absolutely really positive in terms of mental health being discussed. And then I think, like anything else, I do think we're living in a society that is really willing to, instead of just allow the human condition to exist, always has to have a label for it. And I think in COVID, there's a new DSM categorization for a specific type of grief, like a mental illness. Grief is now a mental illness. And like, when we come to
the DSM used to be a small book, much smaller, and now it's like a doorstop.
That's right.
It's huge.
And so we're medicalizing. Yeah. What like my complaint is, we're consistently finding new ways to turn clinical and compartmentalize and medicalize and treat like a symptom, rather than just looking at what the hell is, why do we have social, like just the mere fact that we have famous psychologists on social media, and they have millions of people that are following them for mental health advice, that is into time stuff, right? Like in of itself. And what I think, it's all good, it's all bad, whatever. But I do think that like, it's the bigger picture of, oh my God, how do we get here?
Out of every movement, there's positivity, and there's also people that use it for their own kind of narcissistic advantage.
Yes.
And that's the part that I'm really struggling with, because you have a lot of people who learned a vocabulary without really understanding what that vocabulary is representing, and then are kind of constructing conversation and actions around a kind of very surface level understanding of something.
Yeah.
And even
yes,
one more person says to me, like, oh, my boundary's being crossed. Like, why? Because I asked you where that thing was that you were supposed to give to me at that time. No, I'm not crossing your boundary. I'm just
asking
you to be accountable in your job or whatever the thing is.
You see, I feel like such an old woman right now these days. But I think a lot of this stuff, like things that are meant to be tools, turn into weapons really easily. And I've had people use their boundaries against me even before this vocabulary. But I like listening to Africa Brooke. I think like self-censorship. Mm-hmm. I think like stuff that I think we're in an interesting age where no one even knows anything anymore. And we're all just...
Well, people know things, they just don't want to talk about it. They don't want to say it. I think there's a lot of restriction on where you can say certain things and how you can say certain things. And I think, I don't know, personally, I think there's just a monumental censorship going on.
Yeah.
And pop psychology is giving people tools that feed into that culture of, you got to say it like this, do it like this, use this language, use the when you, I feel statement, otherwise you're hostile or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Is. Yeah.
It feels very restrictive to me at times as opposed to freeing, which is what I know the intention is.
Yes. Yeah. Aunt Adrienne Marie Brown's We Will Not Cancel Us. That comes to mind.
Oh, yes.
I think about the only thing I can ever answer for it is just my own experience, my own self. And I think what I've been trying to, so I haven't written or put anything out in months, and I've been trying to write one thing just to put it out, just to pull the bandaid off. Like, I've been off of social media. I haven't been posting anything anywhere.
How's that feel?
It's really good, really healthy. But also, I think there's this idea that I've been gone for 9 months. Did something profound happen to me? Did I grow? And I just took 9 months off. And
well, you're not quite sure yet because you're only going to know in
time. That's right. And so there's that, which is, you can go away, but you have to come back with something better or whatever. But so there's that pressure. But I do think what's interesting is that
I do feel like I have, my censorship is really specific in that I'm afraid of being seen for who I am as a fucking human. And I think like I have spent 6 or 7 years having people comment on things about me to my face anonymously in email. That's been livable, right? Like I've survivable. It's not been healthy, but it's been survivable. But I think there was like an internal shift that's happened with me where when I started this, I was like, I was still bulimic. I was still really struggling. I figured it out. It was like, I'm figuring it out. And I feel like I crossed into some sort of territory where I just became very afraid that like people would see a crack in the facade and take me down for it. Like, it's just, somewhere along the way, I cut off the pieces of my humanity and really have spent a lot of time focusing on just making sure the good stuff shows. And I know I'm not alone in it. And part of the censorship is only being one-dimensional and only showing the good parts of myself. Or if I'm showing like the sad parts, it still is wrapped up in a lesson instead of just acknowledging, well, I can be a shitty, terrible person sometimes. What I have been thinking about is how much I'm afraid to let the fullness of who I am come to surface.
Let yourself be seen in your entirety. Yes.
Like in my insecurity, my vulnerability, my pettiness or whatever. Because I definitely am okay with having my kindness show and my virtue show.
Yeah,
my intelligence.
Things, right?
That for me has been Wayne, which is like, I just want to be able to fuck up. And the only person that's really keeping me from doing that is me.
Is you. Yeah. It's interesting because over the last hour, you and I have talked about a lot of things. And one of the things we have talked about is brutal pain and being in it. And that certainly is not tied up in a nice bow. Yeah. That is, it is what it is. And it is brutal and rough and raw and messy.
Ugh.
And
just like, you know, so humbling. And I think the thing that's beautiful about it is when someone else is going through it, you get to say, oh, I know what that is.
You bear witness to it. Yeah. And it is strangely comforting. So I'm sorry that you're going through it, but I'm also relieved to hear you are, because I don't feel so alone with it. And that is the beauty of letting ourselves be seen. And it's the beauty of sharing our journeys and having community. And that's why I do this podcast. I do this because I want to share my story. I want to share other women's stories because I know that the women listening, there's going to be somebody who's listening to us right now and going, oh, thank God they spoke about that immense pain they're both in, because I'm in it too.
Yeah.
And so for you listening, whoever you are, and if there's more of the one of you, let's check back in another few months and see where we're at. But this too shall pass.
Yes.
And it doesn't stay this way forever. The good and the negative.
Yeah.
It all passes.
It all does somehow.
Holly, thank you for taking
the
time.
Thank you. What a refreshing and like good. This is a good therapy session.
I feel a lot better than I did when I sat down.
I do too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.